Hey, it's Biggs. So we had some scheduling conflicts, so we can't do box office battle today. But I didn't want to leave you empty-handed. As you may or may not know, me and Zach do a podcast called The Thin Men. It's a podcast for the Myrna Loy. We do interviews with artists. We also do movie reviews of independent cinema. And since we cover independent cinema quite a bit on Box Office Battle, I figured we'd take all the reviews that we've done and just cull them together. And if you do like it, you can go to thethinmen.blogspot.com and you can get them there. Or you can just go to iTunes and look up The Thin Men. And you'll see me and Zach sitting there all fat next to a fireplace. So I really hope you enjoy it. And without further delay, here we go.
Please keep in mind the views expressed on the Thin Men podcast reflect those of the hosts and the hosts alone. They are not necessarily representative of the Myrna Loy Center or its staff. Thank you.
So on this podcast, in addition to talking with people in the performing arts around Helena, Montana, but once again, you may see them in your area if you keep an eye out. We're also going to be discussing independent movies, performance movies, things that you might see not necessarily in a big theater.
A lot of limited release features.
Yeah.
A lot of the things that might fly under the radar of your regular film coverage.
So what did you see this week, Zach? That's will be at the Myrna Loy if you happen to be in Helena, Montana.
That's correct. I saw a film called Revenge of the Green Dragons. It's directed by Andrew Lau and Andrew Liu and produced by Martin Scorsese. It's a crime gang drama set in 1980s Chinatown in New York City. You can see Scorsese's fingerprints all over it in terms of an influence and his role as the producer. It really does seem like the type of script he might have taken had his career gone a different way. It's not going to change the way you see films, but if you like gang crime dramas, you will be really into this movie. It shows a perspective that you don't see a lot in these gang movies that often focus on Italian gangs or Russian gangs, those various mafias. The Green Dragons are a gang that exists in New York City, in Chinatown between Queens and Brooklyn. And the film follows two brothers named Sonny and Steven who try to escape sort of the depression and the poverty of the lives they're living in. They're both immigrants from immigrant families, and they join this gang to try to support themselves, and they very quickly rise through the ranks, which brings unwanted police attention led by Ray Liotta.
Oh, nice.
Further strengthening the Scorsese connection.
I was going to say that the immigrants, kind of
big theme for him.
Yeah, definitely.
And Ray Liotta is fantastic in the film. The two actors playing the brothers are very good as well. They're both relatively unknown. In fact, most of the cast is relatively unknown. The two brothers are played by actors named Justin Chan and Kevin Wu. I've never seen them in anything before this. The one member of the Young Green Dragons people might know is an actor named Harry Shum, who appeared on Glee for a number of seasons. He is very much unlike his character in Glee. That I can say for certain.
He doesn't belt out in a song in the middle?
No, I'm afraid not. The relationship between the brothers is really well played by these two actors. It's very fascinating, and it sort of forms the stress and the tension of the film as they fall in love with the same woman, and they also sort of take different paths through the gang, and it sets them at odds, eventually leading to the point where Sonny becomes estranged and starts to take revenge on the gang and take the fight to the gang. It's a very exciting movie. It's got a good sense of humor, a good dark sense of humor. It's just gorgeously shot. It's got these greens and blues in the color palette that really give it this very distinct visual identity.
How much of a hand do you think Scorsese had in this movie? You mentioned kind of the DNA of Scorsese.
Directly, I would say his hand was mostly in probably shepherding this movie to distribution and to release.
So it was most likely something he saw, liked, and helped
yes,
it get into
that's the impression
audience.
I have. You can see his fingerprints is very much indirectly. The tone of the movie, the look of the movie, the feel of the characters are all very much inspired from various Scorsese works. You see a lot of Gangs of New York in it, especially in the way it's shot. You see a lot of, you actually get a little bit of Raging Bull.
Really?
From the now, it's not a dead connection, but you get that sort of intensity, that very serious, straightforward intensity you get from Raging Bull. But it does have most in common, of course, with his crime dramas.
Now, who does Ray Liotta play in this? I'm guessing he's not in the gang.
He is not in the gang. No, he leads the police who are trying to bring down the gang, and he is part of the attention brought on by the quick rise of these two brothers. So he sets out looking for them as he's already trying to take down the gang.
Do you think the movie accomplishes what it sets out to do?
It absolutely does. When it would come to recommending a movie like this, it's not so great that I would feel comfortable recommending it to everybody. But if these sort of dark crime dramas are in your wheelhouse, with the dark humor and the violence, it is a violent film. It's got a lot to offer, and it's very rewarding in that regard if you like those types of films.
Now, I know a lot of gangster movies have violence for the sake of violence. There's also other ones that have violence for the sake of freaking people out and showing that violence is not okay. I would list a lot of Scorsese movies in that camp.
Yes.
Like they make the audience kind of squeamish when you watch it, which is the idea. You're not supposed to be comfortable when something awful happens. Would you say this movie fits into the first mold or the second mold?
It fits mostly into the second mold. I would say it fits into the first mold in the same way a John Woo movie might, wherein it's violence for violence's sake, but only in terms of the aesthetic.
Like, so it's kind of stylized?
A little bit. It's less stylized and more about how the way the violence unfolds visually, each moment could be sort of taken out and looked at as almost a still life photograph that tells its own little story. So there's a bit of violence for the sake of violence in terms of an artistic aesthetic that's being aimed for. But for the most part, the violence is not treated as something you should strive for in your own personal life.
Another hallmark of the gangster genre, which, by the way, is probably my favorite genre, is that a lot of them are morality tales. Would you say that this is a morality tale?
To a degree, I wouldn't say that it exists to serve sort of the thematic thesis of the film or the moral thesis of the film. It doesn't exist to serve that. It has it to a degree, but that it really is more about following these two brothers. It's very straightforward in that aspect of its storytelling.
Who would you say the audience is for this movie?
Who the audience? I would actually say, and this may come as a surprise, but the audience surrogate to a degree is Ray Liotta, because he's the one who sort of introduces people to this world. Now, obviously, we see this world without the help of Ray Liotta, but he introduces us to it insofar as to people who have no perspective regarding this world at all, or even no knowledge that this gang activity exists in New York Chinatown. He's very important in helping sort of catch the viewer up on what these people do, who they are, what they're capable of.
So it's seen through his eyes, essentially?
I guess I would say those specific things are. The film itself is very much not.
Okay.
The film is very much told through the eyes of the two brothers. But he becomes the audience for certain specific bits of information the audience would need. He's a bit of an exposition machine in the movie, but all that does is allow Ray Liotta to chew scenery, which is what he does best. So it works out for everybody.
Okay. At the end of the day, would you suggest to watch it?
I would say yes. I would say yes, with the caveat being if you don't like gangster movies, this movie is not the one that's going to change your mind.
So today I watched the movie The Blue Room. This is a French film that's, I guess, an erotic whodunit. There's a lot of subtitles, but the way that they pace it, there's visual things going on, but they hold on things long enough to where you can read what's going on and then see the action without missing anything. So it's about a husband who winds up having an affair with a woman whose husband owns a prominent pharmacy in town. He's seems to be falling deeper into this affair, and we get hints right away that she's going to off her husband. We also learn along the way that he is ill, and so he doesn't have long, so it's not necessarily cut and dried that she is going to kill him. So that's one element of did she or didn't she. I don't want to give away a lot about this movie because it's very vague in its ending, and I don't think I'm spoiling anything here, but there are at least four possibilities of what could have happened in this movie. And one thing that I really enjoyed about this is American films, very rare is the occasion where they have an ending where they really leave it open and leave it for people to decide. Mm-hmm. You really have to gather the few facts that they give and people's reaction to things for you to decide what exactly went down. The way that I basically looked at it is the possibilities are the wife could have killed her husband and then killed his wife.
Mm-hmm.
She might have not killed her husband and it was an accident, but then he killed his wife. She might have killed both of them. Or a fourth thing that I will not reveal, but I'm betting if people watch it, there's a subtle thing in there, but I think there is a potential twist. But once again, it's left on you to decide what exactly, you know, it meant.
So they want to play a lot with ambiguity in the way we perceive this story and these characters.
Definitely. And the thing that really stands out at me the most is the facial expressions that people give. The lead of the movie and
Mathieu Amalric. Yeah. I can say with 70% certainty that's how you pronounce his name. He's also the writer and director of the film.
Okay. He does an excellent job of just the facial expressions he gives during the movie. He's really good at kind of deadpanning a lot of scenes, but just the little twinges of things that he does really speak volumes in this movie. And it spends a lot of the movie where you're watching him, you're just like, wow, this guy is so over his head. And why he's over his head is on you to really decide, you know, is he involved in this murder? Is he not? Is it a murder to begin with? Like, once again, there are a lot of questions and there are not a lot of answers, but I feel like the journey through it was interesting. It's definitely not done in a way that I've seen an American movie.
Interesting.
And it's not meant to be insulting when I say this, but your typical movie in the States, they're going to spoon feed you a lot of things, you know? They don't, like, if they have subtle things, they really stand out in the movie. Mm-hmm. And this really is not that way at all, you know? It's left on us to do all the work in our head.
So this is not the kind of movie that's going to talk down to you and walk you through everything?
No, not at all. Not on either front. I mean, even with her reactions, you really can't tell if she's setting him up. Is she crazy and doing this, or is it just sort of misunderstandings? There was definitely a murder in the movie. As to whether her husband's murdered or not, we just don't know for sure.
Okay.
I really enjoyed it. You know, it was definitely a good escape to sit in there and kind of watch it and just lose yourself in it. I'd also like to say, I haven't watched a movie for a while that hasn't been in an aspect ratio that would be like widescreen.
Oh, sure.
And at first I was like, well, that's kind of a strange choice, but somehow it feels a lot bigger than it is on the screen.
Oh, that's cool. So having that sort of the aspect ratio he's referring to this film being in is that that classic.
Is that 4:3?
Yeah, the classic 4:3 golden age of Hollywood, like box square.
Yeah, like you could put it on an old school TV and it would look perfect. Wouldn't miss anything.
And it's interesting that you bring that up, how choosing to shoot in that race, that ratio sort of lends a grandiosity to the proceedings, even for the mundane stuff, just by how much it takes up of the screen.
Yeah, it's really strange. So one of the things that really struck me when DVD became popular, you know, I was one of those guys who's always, when widescreen came out on VHS, I'd be like, yeah, why do you want to watch this? And then when DVD came out, it was a whole nother ball game because the pictures look so muddy when you watched it on a TV screen before, and you would see it in the movie theater, but it never really translated on the small screen until DVDs started coming out, and then obviously later Blu-ray. But when I watch this, somehow they frame things so that, you know, they do a lot of pull-away shots where they're for example, there's a scene at a beach and you see the whole beach in one part, and it just, it looks so big, and it's just, it's amazing how you could do that with this small box, you know?
Yeah, sure.
So I really think whoever did the cinematography on this really did an incredible job for what they had. And I don't know if it was an artistic choice to do it in 4:3 or not, but if it was, you could certainly make a case that they did a great job at it, because it's stunning for being 4:3. And I can't think of anything else that I would necessarily say that in.
Interesting. Okay.
You know, there hasn't been a show in a long, long time that looked good that wasn't in a widescreen.
Yeah, I think the last major film that came out in 4:3 was The Artist.
Okay. I actually missed that one.
Sure. So. Okay. I want to ask about the themes of Blue Room a little bit. Something that sort of struck me, I sort of see a parallel with Blue Room and Gone Girl. And now, like the rest of America, you and I have seen Gone Girl. And with, I mean, even going past sort of the superficial plot similarities, I'm wondering how much thematically they're covering the same ground in terms of, it, say, a perspective on both relationships and investigation into domestic issues.
You know, they're really not covering the same ground as Gone Girl. I mean, obviously, did the husband do it or not?
Right,
there,
that question's
which
present.
Is really like a kind of a genre thing anyway.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
This movie, it doesn't play with really any of the ideas that Gone Girl does.
Okay, so they,
outside of the ambiguity as to whether he did it or not. But even in Gone Girl, there's clues both ways that hit you over the head in that movie. There are no such clues in this movie.
Okay.
You know? And it's not a commentary on how investigators look at something, which was very apparent in Gone Girl. This is more, if anything, I would say it's a character study.
Okay.
And maybe that's why there aren't a lot of answers. And I just saw this, so I guess I'm working through this as we're talking.
For full disclosure, he walked out of this like a half hour ago.
Yeah. Yeah, and we had to record quick to get this up. But so I am decompressing these thoughts as I go, so I
Absolutely.
Apologize if I'm not as in-depth as people would like me to be. But there's a lot of character studying in this of the main character, and it's really his story. And you see other people in the peripheral of looking at him, and you have to make decisions on them
based on how reliable their perspective is, and
off of his perspective.
Okay.
He is if he's not in every scene,
he's in close to it.
He is crucial to every scene. Like, this is very much a story in his eyes.
Okay.
But as in terms of if there's any murders that happen, he's not giving it in the movie. So
okay. Yeah. So you got it. Okay. Now the actor, we talked about him a little bit earlier, Mathieu Amalric, he's huge in France, like a superstar in France. He's crossed over in America to varying degrees of success. He was the bad guy Dominic in Quantum of Solace.
Yes.
He was.
And does a great job in that, by
yes.
the way.
Yes. He's the lead in Diving Bell and a Butterfly, which is a beautiful film if you haven't seen it. Very beautiful film. Now, this is the first time he's written a screenplay, which is adapted from a fairly well-known book by a Belgian writer named Georges Simenon. And it's his first time behind the camera as a director. So did this feel like knowing nothing about this guy going in, did this feel like a rookie directing?
No. No, it felt very masterfully done. I mean,
yeah.
I could see now, knowing that he was the director, that makes sense that, you know, it hangs on him a lot. It definitely plays to his strengths.
Okay.
And so I think that was definitely something that the film benefited from, was the fact that he knew where he could hang, you know, in front of the camera and how long. Because that's the thing, they would pay scenes where you would just be watching him for, you know, 2-3 minutes giving responses to police officers. And that could have been grueling and boring
in
you know, with a lot of actors.
And,
yeah, in different hands. But he really knows where to make the cut and how long to hang on everything, you know?
Sure.
So, like I said, it's a slower pace, but it's the right pace for this movie, clearly. Did he do the editing as well?
I don't have the full crew in front of me. I believe in my research, he was involved with the editing, but he was not the primary editor. There was another name. The editor was François Gédiger, and the cinematographer you were talking about earlier is Christophe Boncarn.
One other thing I really wanted to mention in this movie, there are orchestral swells throughout this movie, and you don't even really realize there's not a lot of music through most of the movie until the swells happen in the big emotional parts. Mm-hmm. And it's just done so well. So much of it conveys what's happening because everything's so tight-lipped,
mm-hmm.
you know, with this character, which you can understand if you're in front of police officers being interrogated.
Be yeah.
You're not going to want to volunteer a whole lot. That's played right, but it's definitely punctuated by the music that they do choose to put in. And I don't know why, but there are certain swells in this movie that really reminded me of The Godfather, which is
Ooh.
An ultimate compliment.
Ooh,
to me,
that's high
one
praise.
Of my favorite movies. And but it's not, the music isn't prominent like The Godfather. They definitely pick their spots, but where they pick it, it really works.
Interesting.
You know, and it's a lot of orchestra building,
mm-hmm. a lot of crescendos.
Not, but it doesn't necessarily crescendo into anything. It's just building and building and building, and then it just slowly fades out.
Okay.
You know, and they do a really great job of calling your attention to emotions that might be there that are very, very small. And I think that's a real credit to whoever did the music for
so
this movie.
It sort of sounds like the key word for this movie is subtlety. It's handled yeah. with a degree of sort of self-awareness and subtlety in every decision that's made along the creative process.
It's definitely one of the most subtle movies I've seen in a long, long time.
That's
so.
A quality I'm married to. I'm going to go hard pitch for the listeners out there for a second. For those of you who are still on the fence, if you are listening to us talk about it and thinking, well, this sounds interesting, but a slow pace, it's probably a long, pretentious French movie. Guess what, guys? 76-minute runtime.
Yeah.
You're in and out of this thing in under an hour and a half.
Yeah, and like I said, the long scenes, they don't feel long.
Mm-hmm.
That's funny you said 76 minutes, because I really figured it was like a two-hour movie. I didn't know.
Yeah.
But it felt the right run length.
It felt like it was supposed to be. So that's another credit to the editor that, I mean, being, because it sounds like there's so much they could have either kept in or brought in, depending on what scene, what type of scene it was, yeah, and whether it was in the screenplay.
I'm willing to bet there's some things that hit the cutting room floor. I'd be interested in reading the book just to know
yeah.
if there's more definite answers in the book, because it very well might have been a choice to leave out a lot of those answers mm-hmm. and just leave it vague so that people had to kind of draw their conclusions. And if that was a choice, it was definitely a good choice, because it just works, man. I don't know how to sell this movie to you in any other way other than it really works and you should see it.
Yes, please do. Please come by the Myrna Loy Center. It's going to be held over for at least another week. Please come by and check it out. You won't have to try to leave home in the cold at midnight if you come see it. If you're not in Montana, just take a look around, see if it's playing near you, because if it is, this is one worth checking out. It's a unique type of movie that you don't get to see a lot of. You know, support independent film. Support filmmakers like Mathieu Amalric, where you see a lot of these actors who go into writing and directing and they do their own project. They have a tendency to be sort of precious about the movie in general and afraid to cut out the fat, and also precious about their performance and their vanity. And Mathieu Amalric has none of this.
No.
None of it. He does not have the type of ego or vanity that would allow him to single-handedly balloon this movie into something sort of swollen and unnecessary and bloated.
And since we're talking about this, let's just put all the cards on the table. There's a lot of tentpole movies out there, and I'm no different than anybody else.
Anyone who's listened to us podcast before knows very well that we are in for the overwhelming majority of blockbusters.
Yes. But, you know, there is room for the smaller movies, and we're not seeing them outside of independent cinema anymore,
mm-hmm.
or from movies from other countries. I mean, this is where we're seeing those smaller movies that touch a lot of lives when you see them, you know?
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
It's really important to see these movies when they come out, because otherwise they're going to go away.
And it's especially important to come out and see them when they're good, and especially when they're really good, like
right.
this one, when they stand out from the back.
Yeah, I'm not saying to just support anything, but
yeah.
support pieces of cinema.
Because this is how you get more of it. And if you're the type of person who maybe doesn't watch French films all that often outside of maybe once or twice a year firing something up on Netflix, you know, put your foot out and put your toe in the water. The water's fine. Come join us.
Yeah, and I'll put it out there. You know how many French films I've seen? One. And I just talked about it. So You know, I'm not wearing a beret here. Really enjoyed this movie.
This is not a pretentious, angry that he didn't have his own film career critic telling you this. This is two guys who just really love going to movies and love the entertainment value of them.
I haven't even smoked a closed cigarette in like 15 years. So.
Social satire written and directed by a first-time director named Justin Simien. It focuses on four, but primarily two, black students at a fictional Ivy League college called Winchester University. The two de facto main characters that we follow are Lionel and Samantha. Samantha is a student. She's a radio DJ, and she has a show called Dear White People. One of the first things we hear her say on her show is, the new rule to prove you aren't racist is you have to have at least two black friends, and your drug dealer Tyrone does not count. And we follow Lionel, who's a young, gay, black, sort of nerdy outcast. Who has trouble fitting in. He loves Robert Altman movies. He has a great scene where he talks about how his love of Robert Altman movies makes him feel sort of ostracized from the various black clubs and social groups on campus. He's also Chris from Everybody Hates Chris.
Oh.
That show. What sort of becomes the thrust of the film is an all-black dorm on the campus is potentially going to start being integrated. Samantha takes a stand against this on her show and eventually becomes the new president of that dorm to represent it in academic matters, including a lot of scenes with Dennis Haysbert, who's one of the deans of the school, and he's fantastic in the film.
What would I know him from?
He was the president in 24, and he lets us know every night that we are in all states' good hands.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah.
He used to be Serrano in Major League, right?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
So a high pedigree of actors.
Yes. High quality. As this sort of starts to spark a lot of controversy and discussion on the campus, the school newspaper, which is entirely white, hires Lionel to work on the paper to cover this whole thing as he has.
So would he be considered a token?
Absolutely. On the poster, they show the form. On one of the posters, there's the four main characters, and it breaks them all down. And he is the token. And what sort of a lot of the comedy we get from that is they hire him to cover this because he's black, except for he has like no relationship with sort of the black culture at the school. He doesn't feel like he's a part of it. And so he's stumbling through and trying to guess about what's appropriate and what's not as much as anybody else on the newspaper would have been. The thing that I liked most about the film is that nobody gets off easy, right? But also nobody, for the most part, there are a few characters who are, but for the most part, nobody is completely demonized either. Everyone in the film is portrayed as being very complex individuals, which is what you want, especially for a satire like this that can already be on touchy ground to begin with. It's a very touchy subject. And it's so easy for a film like this to go incredibly hyperbolic in either a very anti-black or anti-white direction. It's about blackness, but it's not about blackness as opposed to whiteness in like a militant battle. Although there are characters in the film who sort of represent that point of view, it's sort of about blackness and what that means in terms of humanness and what that means in terms of a primarily white culture, like an Ivy League institution. And a lot of the film builds up to this party that's held on the campus that is everyone in blackface.
Oh,
and this sort of becomes the climax of the film, is at this big party. And so all the various threads lead to this moment. And it's some of the scenes in that are really, really, really powerful and very hard to watch. There's a moment where one of the characters, Coco, she's a black girl who wants to be, she's a video blogger and she has celebrity aspirations. And she only dates white men. She wears blue contacts and wigs to sort of downplay her blackness into what would be seen, I suppose, as a more palatable version of blackness for a greater audience. And there's an amazing scene where she sort of breaks down at this party. She sees how black people are viewed and how she's treated by these people. And it's an incredible bit of acting. The acting is top notch. The Lionel character is immediately likable and relatable. Tessa Thompson is incredible in the film. She's able to show so many shadings, and when you see her interacting with these various characters that she has histories with, you can feel, just in the way she looks at them, like you can get a sense of their whole history together. It's an incredibly fascinating performance, and you can see why that's the kind of performance you want to build the movie around. I think my biggest criticism of the movie is that there's almost too much going on, and it's not a wildly long film. It's about 110 minutes, but there's so much plot going on that
probably could have lost a C-plot.
It almost makes me think that this would have worked better as a television show. And I would be very interested in seeing sort of a longer serialized version of this type of story. There are a lot of things that they get super deep into. There are a lot of things that they sort of just brush over that you would like to see them get deep into, but there's just not enough time. And the alternate version would completely taken out some of the characters entirely and just focused solely on those two that I've talked most about. I don't think the problem was in the editing so much as it was in there's just too much in the script, period. Okay. Like, it's something that there probably needed to be another draft or a hefty reimagining of the story. The problem with cutting stuff out from the script, and normally when you see a writer-director whose movie has a little too much going on, the feeling I generally get is that they are very precious about their work and they didn't cut it out. This, I genuinely felt like cutting anything out of this movie would have been a big mistake. It would have vastly hurt the movie in a myriad of different ways. It would have not served the film's goals. The problem being is that it doesn't really serve the film's goals to have some of these scenes or moments in their sort of hyper-compressed form.
With any movie you have that has social commentary,
yes,
there's always the risk that it gets too preachy.
Yes.
Would you say this walks the line okay, or does it dip down too far in one direction?
No, this is handled with an incredible amount of subtlety so that it never feels like an overbearing lecture that's being pounded over your head. Some of the characters are very preachy, but that comes off not as something to be hated about them or loved about them, just as a fact of who they are, that they're very passionate about these things. And there are other characters who are in opposition to their preachiness. So if anything, the satire, this is another thing I like, that this movie has got its tongue firmly in its own cheek. It's not afraid to make fun of itself and what it's trying to do. It's not afraid to make fun of its characters, even the ones it likes.
It doesn't take itself too seriously.
No, it sees the absurdity in a lot of these things. And so when you have these preachy characters, there's an element of the film making fun of people who get over the top with their preachiness to the point that nobody wants to listen to them. And it does the same for the people who want to stay out of it entirely, even though staying out of it is detrimental to them.
Okay, another potential pitfall of movies like this are in 15 years, it seems really irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
Put on your future hat.
My
here.
Prognosticating.
Yes.
Hat.
Do you think in the future this will seem dated? Do you think this will be a movie that stands the test of time, like you'll be able to watch it in 15 years? Or do you think the things that they talk about are themes that we care about right now and may be muted or changed?
I think to a certain degree, it's six of one, half dozen of the other. There are themes in the film that would resonate whether the movie came out 20 years ago or 20 years in the future. There are some things that are very much specific to our time, like these blackface parties. There's a bit in the credits where they show pictures of these blackface parties happening at real colleges.
So this really happens.
Oh, yeah. Oh, moho. Wow, so man. Much.
I just lost some faith
so
in
so much.
Here.
Yeah, there's a ton of pictures in the end.
Because when you said that, the first thing I thought about was, in the vein of why I asked the question, was there's a movie that came out when I was in high school called Philadelphia, and at the time, it seemed really powerful. But you go back and watch it, now it's where Tom Hanks got his first actor, but you watch it now, and it feels like it's like, see, gay people are people, too.
Yeah.
You can be friends with gays. You can, like, do all these things and you won't get AIDS. And, you know, it right. comes off as awful when you watch it now.
Right.
But it's because it just aged really poorly.
And I think there are elements of this film that will feel very much tied to their time, but I don't think they'll come off as awful. All the sort of themes and discussions, especially regarding race and race relations and sort of being, there's a lot of talk about being a black face in a white space and what that means. And I think a lot of that will ring true. I think a lot of it will probably no longer feel relevant in the future, but I don't think it'll feel irrelevant in a way where you look back and you're like, oh, that's sort of childish, or it will feel irrelevant in a way where you say, oh, isn't it awesome that we don't have to talk about this anymore, that we've got it, at least this specific thing, we have it under control now? And I think that's sort of the hope when you have these social satires is, I think to a certain degree, you want them to become irrelevant, and you want them to become irrelevant because the points they make are no longer valid in the modern world.
Stepping back from all the social commentary and mm-hmm. everything in it, how does the film look?
It borrows a little bit from sort of the Wes Anderson and Quentin Tarantino style of filmmaking, where there are title cards in splitting the film up into chapters. The cinematography is not as stylized as either of those two directors. It's a very fastball down the middle, straightforward, clean, classic cinema look, which I actually think helps the film. And I could be wrong because I haven't seen the film with a very distinct visual image, but I feel like if you saw it in, say, a Wes Anderson-esque style or a Scorsese-esque style or a whoever who has a very specific, definitive sort of palette and visual language, I almost feel like it would distract from the message of the film. I think that keeping the cinematography very straightforward sort of helps to keep the message clear. And when I say that it's very straightforward, I don't mean to say it's bad. It's very clean. The colors are bright. It's sharp. It's well framed. Like, you can tell it's done by someone with some skill. It's just, it's not flashy in any way. There's nothing about it that immediately jumps out and you go, oh, wow, this is just gorgeous cinematography. It's cinematography that stays out of the way of the script.
It just serves the script.
Exactly. It's all done to serve the ideas and the characters and the story rather than to sort of be a standout part of the film in and of itself.
How about the acting?
Acting is very good. Very, very good. These young actors they got are so nuanced and striking in their performances. They're all very different from each other, so they're able to sort of bring different things to the table, but a lot of them cover so much ground in what they're asked to do in the script that you get to see this whole range of emotion from them, and they're very, very good. An editor on the newspaper that the Lionel character works for, who's played by an actor named Kyle Gallner. So at first glance, you're like, oh, he seems like a nice guy. And by the end of the movie, you hate that character's guts. And so even these minor characters who in a film handled with less touch and, I guess, diligence towards its characters and its story, this character could easily come across as a sort of stereotypical scene-chewing 80s Billy Zabka movie teen villain. And he doesn't at all. He has a very real arc, even though he's a incredibly minor character who, more than anything, is there to serve a purpose in the story. I mean, this is not a character who we are diving deeply into the motivations or the agency of. It's not a character who is meant to be a focus. This is a character who's there to advance other characters' stories. And even these minor characters have their little arcs. So the act, and I think that's a testament to both the acting and the writing.
Give us the hard pitch for this movie.
In a world where movies are designed to create buzz, this is a movie that creates a conversation. And when a film is so ostentatious to have a title like Dear White People that immediately grabs you by the throat and says, hey, pay attention. It's something important to, at the very least, hear what they have to say. You know, whether you think the satire is completely off base, whether you think the satire is dead on and you're completely on board, it's just important to hear what they have to say if they're going to be so brash about what they're presenting. And luckily, the brashness, the sizzle is backed up by the steak in this regard. This is a very substantial film. It's a thought-provoking film, and it's a conversation-starting film.
How long can we see this for, you think?
Well, it will be held over through next week, possibly another week after that, if people keep coming out. Thank you.
Hello, what can I do for you today?
Well, I am looking for Christmas presents for my family. Just, I really let it go this year. Do you have anything good for me?
Of course, the We Had a Good Life podcast, which you can find on the Not Safe for Network.
A podcast? I guess I was thinking more like a Furby, maybe?
Maybe Montucky Skies is more up your alley.
I guess, is that also a podcast? Because again, I'm looking for something a little more tangible.
Podcast? Why, speak no further. We've got Box Office Battle.
You know, I gotta say, I'm beginning to feel like you're not listening to me. Again, looking for gifts like I can put in a box or a bag and wrap them for my friends and family.
Perhaps shooting the show would be more your speed.
You know, work with me, not for me. Let's work as a, let's try to attack this as a team. Again, gifts, family.
Is your family into art?
Sure, yeah.
Well, then the Thin Man podcast would be right up your alley.
All right, do you have something that's not a podcast? Because this is a little frustrating.
Real Roulette isn't a podcast anymore, but we do have the archives available on the Not Safe for Network.
I mean, it seems pretty clear at this point you have an agenda. You're not going to sell me the toy robot. You're not going to sell me the beautiful handbag. And you're not going to sell me that cool poncho. What are you going to sell me?
That's debatable. It's a podcast about arguing.
You know, I gotta say, at this point, I feel like I understand arguing. So I'm tempted, but again, not what I'm looking for.
So you're looking for something tangible that you can hold in your hands.
Ideally.
Well, why not the Not Safe for Network podcast, which you can hold in your hands on your iPod or MP3 player?
Sure, that counts.